Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmandel and I'm your host. On today's program, One History of Community Radio, Part 2. I'll continue my conversation with Bill Thomas, one of the founding members of Community Radio WEFT, where the Media Geek radio show is produced, the flagship station of the Media Geek Network. And also, some very sad news in the world of indie media and for the people of Oaxaca, Mexico. Do stay tuned. On October 27th, Brad Will, a reporter for Global Indie Media, was killed in Oaxaca, Mexico, while he was working. He was shot in the torso while documenting an armed paramilitary assault on the popular Assembly of the People of Oaxaca, a fusion of striking local teachers and other community organizations demanding democracy in Mexico. That was the day the last edition of Media Geek was produced and went to air. I learned of it after I produced that program, which is why I'm reporting on it here. This program is being produced in advance of its November 3rd air date, so there may be more news since then and more things going on in Oaxaca. But by all accounts right now, as I'm producing this on October 30th, things are very bad there with the military staging assaults on the striking teachers and the popular assembly. So I read to you from a statement released by the New York City Independent Media Center, where Brad Will did much of his work. This was released on October 29th. The members of the New York City Independent Media Center mourn the loss of this inspiring colleague and friend. We want to thank everyone who has sent condolences to our office and posted remembrances to nyc.indymedia.org. We share our grief with the people of our city and beyond who lived, worked, and struggled with Brad over the course of his dynamic but short life. We can only imagine the pain of the people of Oaxaca who have lost seven of their neighbors to this fight, including Emilio Alfonso Fabian, a teacher, and who now face an invasion by federal troops. All we want in compensation for his death is the only thing Brad ever wanted to see in this world, justice. They list, we, along with all of Brad's friends, reject the use of further state-sponsored violence in Oaxaca. The New York City Independent Media Center supports the demand of Reporters Without Borders for a full and complete investigation by Mexican authorities into Oaxaca State Governor Ulises Ruiz Ortiz's continued use of plainclothes municipal police as a political paramilitary force. The arrest of his assailants is not enough. The New York City Independent Media Center also supports the call of Zapatista Subcomandante Insurgente Marcos, quote, to compañeros and compañeras in other countries to unite and to demand justice for this dead compañero, end quote. Marcos issued this call, quote, especially to all the alternative media and free media here in Mexico and in all the world, end quote. Indie Media was born from the Zapatista vision of a global network of alternative communication against neoliberalism and for humanity. To believe in Indie Media is to believe that journalism is either in the service of justice or it is a cause of injustice. We speak and listen, resist and struggle. In that spirit, Brad Will was both a journalist and a human rights activist. He was part of this movement of independent journalists who go where the corporate media do not, or stay long after they are gone. Perhaps Brad's death would have been prevented if Mexican, international, and U.S. media corporations had told the story of the Oaxacan people. Then those of us who live in comfort would not only be learning now about this five-month-old strike or about this 500-year-old struggle. And then Brad might not have felt the need to face down those assassins in Oaxaca holding merely the ineffective shields of his U.S. passport and Prensa Extranjera badge. Then Brad would not have joined the fast-growing list of journalists killed in action or the much longer list of those killed in recent years by troops defending entrenched, unjust power in Latin America. Still, those of us who knew Brad know that his work would never have been completed. From the community gardens of the Lower East Side to the Movimiento Sem Terra encampments of Brazil, he would have continued to travel to where the people who make this world a beautiful place are resisting those who would cause it further death and destruction. Now in his memory, we will all travel those roads. We are the network, all of us who speak and listen, all of us who resist. That is signed, the New York City Independent Media Center. You can find their website at nyc.indymedia.org, where you can learn more about Brad Will and what happened, and read more about what is going on right now in Oaxaca. Other places to turn for news of what is going on in Oaxaca include narconews.com, which has been covering the situation there all year long, as well. Free Speech Radio News has had reporters in Oaxaca, Mexico, which have been reporting on its daily half-hour news program. You can hear Free Speech Radio News on your local community station. You can also listen to it online at fsrn.org. This is Media Geek. Welcome back to Media Geek, your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. I'm Paul Riesmandel. I'm your host. Check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net for the Media Geek blog, and get the program downloaded to your computer, or get the podcast at radio.mediageek.net. This year is the 25th anniversary of community radio station WEFT in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois, home to the Media Geek radio show. In recognition of this important milestone, last week I began a conversation with Bill Thomas, one of the founding members of WEFT. In part one, Bill talked about how the group that built WEFT came together in the early 1970s while the burgeoning community radio movement gained momentum. In part two of this interview, Bill talks about the 6 years spent waiting for the FCC to approve WEFT's licensed broadcast and what the early days of the station were like.
What was really frustrating for us in Champaign-Urbana was it took us a really, really long time to get on the air. And the reason for that was, it's kind of a complicated explanation, but basically we put in our application and it bumped up against this huge application in Chicago for a very, when I say huge, for a very high power station in Chicago by the Moody Bible Institute. And they were kind of exploiting that you really weren't supposed to be able to apply for that high power of a station in the Midwest. And they were kind of exploiting a sort of a loophole in the rules. And we were told by many people, FCC lawyers and engineers and people in Washington, that the FCC was never going to let that Moody Bible Institute station through. They were going to deny that application. So we should just sit tight, that application in Chicago would be bounced out, and then we'd be free to, you know, our application was fine, except for our interference with them. And we waited and waited and waited and waited and for years. And it was very difficult kind of keeping the interest alive, you know, because we'd had some fundraisers where we'd raise a few $100 and we'd ask people to make donations and we'd ask people to work and help try to keep it going. And we kept saying, well, you know, we think, you know, within a few months, this application in Chicago is supposed to be denied. We'll get our application. Then we can start, you know, start putting up a transmitter, start putting an antenna up. But, you know, we don't really, can't really start building until we have the construction permit. And, you know, I think that people, a lot of people began to think, oh, you know, this is never going to happen. You know, this is just going to be one of those things that, like, yeah, right, it's always going to be next year. That period of time where we, you know, were in kind of suspense went on for, you know, like 6 years. I really felt sure that we were eventually going to get permission to go up. But, you know, like I say, I'm sure a lot of people in the community thought, you know, when they'd heard about, well, you know, we were going to have another chili supper or pancake breakfast or something to raise money, that, you know, they kind of rolled their eyes and and thought that this is never going to come through. But it did.
And how many years did it take?
Well, I think it was six years before we finally got a construction permit. And then, you know, once we got a construction permit, it wasn't like, you know, we still had to get a transmitter and get an antenna and put them up and you know, actually put a studio together and everything. So, I mean, there was a lot to do. You know, once we got the construction permit, I was I think my title was board chair, I guess, during this period when we were, you know, we'd organized as a nonprofit and we're just going along, and we had a board that was basically few of the people that had been interested. We'd occasionally have some public event to sort of keep people aware that we're still working on this. Bill Taylor was, you know, somebody who was involved all through this time. Joe Lex and Andrea Urban, who I mentioned, were involved up to the point where they moved out of town to take other jobs. Other people came in. But involved basically meant, you know, we'd come to meetings and we'd talk about what to do and plan another fundraiser until we finally got the construction permit. We then organized. We found out I then became eventually the first staff member, first paid staff member. I mean, obviously people were working. And then once we had me, we were able to apply for some grants from actually job programs. There was a program called CETA. You could go to them and you'd say, like, well, you know, if you give us some money, we'll pay people to work here who are unemployed, and, you know, they'll learn job skills and learn things. And there were people who were very interested in WEFT who were eligible. They weren't employed at such a level that they were ineligible. So people that actually gave us some people who could be around all day to work on getting things going. And it, you know, it still was a slow and difficult process to get all this stuff together. We found a station in Chicago that was willing to give us an old transmitter. Basically, they just wanted to get rid of it, and giving it to us was a way to not have to pay somebody to haul it out. And this was an old transmitter. It was like a very, very early FM transmitter. And when Roger Diggle kind of led the group that went up to Chicago to get it, and it was up in a tall building because they used to put the transmitters up in the attics of these tall buildings to be near the antennas. And there had been alterations made to the rooms around it, so you couldn't take it out the doors anymore, and they literally had to dismantle the doors and take apart part of the elevator and everything to get it out of there. It was in the winter. We hauled it back down here. There was an engineer who was sympathetic to us, a broadcast engineer around here, said we could, and he was kind of interested in this old transmitter. He said we could put it on his farm. In the process of driving it out to the farm, the truck slipped off the road in the ice and into the ditch, and we had a terrible time getting it out there, but we finally got it to the farm. We also got an old antenna, again, that was given to us for, like, if you haul it away. And we worked out with the owners of an old hotel in downtown Champaign that was being transformed into a performing arts high school, that we could put up a pole on their roof and put the antenna up there. In order to get on the air, we finally got fed up with waiting for the station in Chicago to be denied, and they never were. So it's a good thing we didn't wait, and we just went in with a lower power application. We originally hoped to have a higher power application to cover basically about what WEFT does now, but we decided to go in, drop our power down, and just get on the air because we were sick of waiting. You know, it didn't take a lot of cash to do all this stuff, but it sure took a lot of people, and, you know, a lot of people working and a lot of people inspired by the idea of getting this radio station going. It was a lot of work.
Had you acquired the downtown space yet at that moment where the studios are now?
At first, we were just renting some office space downtown. We kind of had a preference for downtown Champaign as a place to be, though we could have, you know, if we'd gotten a really good deal somewhere else. And eventually, where the studios are now, we started in there as a rental. It was a very low rental. It's a place it had been being used as a print shop. It was in pretty rough shape. They'd taken out the printing presses, but, you know, it was not a lovely space. And the owners, the Grubb brothers, one particular Grubb brother who handled that building, he kind of, I think he was tickled by us a little bit. Or, you know, we benefited a lot from various people who weren't, you know, they weren't necessarily going to, like, get in there with us and maybe weren't even going to listen to the station that much, but they sort of thought it was interesting or funny or admirable or something, you know, that we were trying to do this. So he gave us a pretty good deal on the rent, and that enabled us to move in there.
I guess reflecting back from 2006, to me, the thing that strikes me is that One, I guess that you would even think you could put this a full power FM station on the air. And I realized that the radio industry and the radio dial looked a lot different and sounded a lot different in 1975. And that you had the 6 years of perseverance to go through the red tape at the FCC to make it happen.
Yeah, it did take a lot of perseverance. I'll tell you something that was really different in 1975, and this had something to do with why there was this wave of community stations going on. There were still, at that time, not in any of the big cities anymore, but in some of the medium and smaller cities, there were open frequencies. There were untaken frequencies on the educational FM band, on the 88 to 92 FM band. There were open slots that just nobody had asked for them yet, and that's not true today. I mean, there's maybe a few places. There's probably out in western North Dakota in one of those counties with only 800 people in the whole county. There's probably some slots where you could put on maybe a 3 kilowatt station or something out there. But they're just all taken now, and that was part of the impetus behind LPFM. But at that time, they weren't all taken. There were a few left. We were aware that there were other people also interested in snapping up these frequencies, mainly religious broadcasters. There was a bit of a kind of a competitive rush to kind of get organized and get applications in then and get that going. But, yeah, it was, in a way, it was sort of presumptuous of us to think that we could do it. And I think what we owe a lot of gratitude to are a few of these people who in the early 70s did get stations on, like KDNA in St. Louis. And you looked at them and you said, well, gosh, if they could do that, maybe we could do it too. I think without that example, I don't know if we would have even thought to try.
And when you were sitting there from 1975 to 1981 organizing, was there a concrete conception of what the station would sound like, of what a community radio schedule would look like?
Well, there was a conception. I probably wasn't too concrete. I mean, I had an idea, but part of my idea, I know, was that it wouldn't all be my idea of part of my idea was that it should be an expression of the community. So I know part of my personal idea was to not lay everything out, because we should be open to things that emerged. I don't know all what everybody else had in their minds, but in a way we didn't want to lay it out too specifically because we didn't want to close off possibilities. I think there were a few ideas that were kind of out there. We used to have something, we'd have these little events that we call listening parties. They were kind of little small fundraiser events where we'd cook up some food or have a potluck or something and listen to tapes from other community radio stations, because we would hear things that way. You'd go like, wow, can you do that on the radio? Can you actually play that music? Can you actually read that poetry? Can you actually talk about that topic? Can you actually have a speech by Malcolm X on the radio? Can you actually play free jazz on the radio? Can you actually play this Ohio bluegrass band on the radio? And we said, yeah, that's the kind of stuff that we're trying to get this radio station started, to be able to do it. And we talked a lot about, having a lot of different people on the air, having a lot of different kinds of music and different kinds of discussion discuss it, that it would be a forum for discussing community issues and that we'd try to have a lot of local things on So we talked about it in those kind of terms. So, that wasn't too specific, but I think it gave people some kind of sense. Probably when the station finally went on the air, I'm sure there were people who said, this isn't like what I thought it was going to be, because, it's kind of, even if you talk about it, it's still, when you actually get there, it might not be exactly what people thought. But, there were definitely ideas out there, and we certainly looked at program guides from other community radio stations to see what they were doing and said, well, yeah, we could do things like this. And so, we were definitely talking about those sorts of possibilities and trying to have some idea without nailing it down too tight.
What did it sound like that the first year or two?
Well, I wish I had tapes to go back and listen to it. I mean, we played you know, we played a lot of music. We had, as I'm sure people at WEF now are aware, good discussion, good talk programming is harder to do than music programming because you got recorded music to play. We certainly did some. But it was kind of random. We would get a call maybe from somebody who was interested in coming on the air to talk about something, and we'd just say, well, why don't you come down about 2 in the afternoon and we'll talk about it on the air. So if you were a listener, you know, you usually didn't know when these were coming. They would just kind of come along that there'd be an interview or a discussion on the air. We tried to have a system to put phone calls on the air, but it wasn't very good, so it was kind of hard to put phone calls on the air. We didn't do that too much. There were certainly a lot of times that the station was painful to listen to because there were just so many mistakes being made as we were trying to build up a group of people who had the on-air skills. But it was especially difficult to get people during the days. So often there were people on the air who were just learning or weren't very good and made mistakes and didn't do things well thought they'd started a piece of music and hadn't, so you had dead air and all those kinds of things that happen. One of the things that we did do was we did manage, and even in those first couple of years, to get a fair amount of local music on the air, considering how easy it is, of course, to play national recorded music. We had inherited a set of reel-to-reel tapes from WTWC of a number of recorded performances that were maybe 90 minutes long or so, and those also came in handy during those times when there wasn't anybody to fill the airtime. So those got played, and we started an event that we called Live on the Air Parties, where these were a combination of live music on the air in the studio and a fundraiser. And I don't know if you guys still do them, but we would have some sort of musician or band, I guess some rock bands, some folk musicians, some bluegrass bands, a variety, some jazz groups. We would have them come down and set up in the studio and play for a couple of hours in the evening, and we would charge admission to people to come in and be there in the station, and we would have some refreshments there. It was a nice little fundraiser and got a lot of people. Was a good way to meet people and get people into the station, and it did get local live music on the air. So, we were making that effort with music. We also did something, I think we did these like a couple of times a year. We did live days where we would do nothing recorded from, like 8 in the morning till 8 at night or something like that. Everything had to be live. There was no recorded music played, no recorded spots, just everything was done live. Those were challenging, and I'm sure sometimes that parts of them were difficult to listen to. We would have, of course, a lot of live music. We'd have live poetry readings. We'd have live interviews and discussions. But just we didn't use turntables. This was before CD players, and no tape recorders, no turntables. All day long, everything was done live. We also experimented, and we continued to do this during the time I was there, with days where we would take an entire day and kind of flip it over to a particular, it would be like a day that would be devoted to a particular thing. One of the most ambitious ones, and this is one that we did more than once, was we would do a day where all the programming would be by women. In the 70s, you would still hear people, I mean, there were still like teachers in communication schools who would say things like, women can't really talk on the air. Women's voices are inherently inferior over the radio. People don't like them. Women on radio were still very unusual. It was just in the 70s, the first woman anchor for any national news show in radio or TV was Susan Stamberg on National Public Radio, the first woman anchor there'd ever been. So women on the radio was still kind of a big issue. So we did these days where the programming would all be done by women, and we would kind of follow the same schedule. If there was a blues show that day, we'd still do the blues show, but we'd have it done by women, and the shows would tend to feature a lot of women artists, you know, stuff like that. We did jazz days and rock and roll days and other days focused on things. You know, and a lot of these ideas, maybe they didn't work out that well in terms of good programming. Sometimes I think they did, but there was a lot of excitement and fun and just, you know, trying some of these different things. There's a few things about how it sounded in the first couple of years. I was on the air a lot because I was the manager, and I was there all the time, and I always filled in whenever anybody didn't show up, so I know I was on the air a lot.
It sounds like there was a very experimental environment and sort of free form.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, it wasn't, yeah, I wouldn't say totally free form, but yeah, we were, I think it was an experimental environment, and, you know, I think you may be in a stage now, it's always good to be open to experimenting. But, you know, we found out a lot of those things probably didn't work that well. It was fun to try them. It was fun to think them up, and it was fun to try them out. And, you know, some of them didn't work that well. So, you know, they probably, it's good that we tried them and probably good that we're not still doing them. It is good to be willing to mess around and try things.
And that was Bill Thomas, one of the founding members of Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois, talking about the very early days of that station. WEFT is home to the Media Geek Radio Show and celebrates its 25th anniversary this year. Bill and I also talked about how and why community radio stations are run the way they are, using democratic organizing principles, and some other topics. You can listen to the rest of that conversation at radio.mediageek.net. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm host and producer Paul Riesmandel. I'll be back in 1 week with another half-hour look at independent and grassroots media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. In the meantime, check out the frequently updated Media Geek blog at mediageek.net. The program can be downloaded at radio.mediageek.net, where you can also subscribe to the podcast. Media Geek is produced at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. The program is also heard on 10 other community stations around North America. They are Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salina, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, WYQZ in Warrenton, Bealeton, Virginia, Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington, and Free Radio San Diego. Media Geek is free to air on your local community station as well. Just email Paul at mediageek.net. That's also the address where you can send your comments about the program. Once again, that's Paul at mediageek.net. Thanks for tuning in.